What do we know today about regional development that we didn't know a decade ago?
How can the cutting edge of academic research and new knowledge help the UK deliver internationally competitive agglomeration economies outside London and levelling up?
And to achieve this, what reforms to economic management and regional governance should the next UK government prioritise after the next general election? I'm Mike Spicer.
And I'm David Marlowe. Welcome to LED Confidential, the podcast that tries to lift the lid on those intractable, enduring challenges facing those of us working in and on local economic development and placemaking today.
And to another exciting episode, as we welcome one of the world's most highly cited and widely published spatial economists and economic geographers of his generation, and currently one of the UK's most sought after and therefore busy social scientists. Let me give Philip McCann a huge welcome to LED Confidential. Thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule, Philip, to join us. We've set out some of the topics it'd be great to go through in our opening provocations. But before we get into those, can I just start by asking you to tell us a little bit about what drove you to regional development as a career choice in the first place, and what continues to motivate and excite you about this area of work?
Firstly, Mike and David, thanks very much for inviting me along. I think for me, it's on several levels. It's one, an intellectual level. These are puzzles. And you know, as an academic researcher, in a sense, that's what motivates me. I'm thinking about puzzles all the time, things that, you know, we ought to know the answer to, and actually we don't. And often these things seem quite obvious at first. The more you think about them, the less obvious they become, the more complicated they become. So one of them is just as an academic researcher, that they're extremely difficult questions to address. At the same time, also as a citizen, they're extremely important to make progress on. The issues economic development specialists are dealing with, I mean, they really are about people's livelihoods, the building and the rebuilding of their communities. For me, this stuff is just central to everything. I mean, it's about good living. It's about how we interact as citizens. It's about the moral obligations that we share and that we frame our existence. And, it's about the rule of law, but it's much more than that. It's about what government means, what law means, what government means. How does that shape how we communicate, how we engage, and how we drive the prosperity and productivity of our world forward, and doing it in the places where we live and operate every day. So there's a range of things. One is a purely intellectual puzzle. I mean, it's a great area to be in because it is so complicated. So on a personal level, it's fantastic. But I think on a societal and a civic and a governance level, these are extraordinarily important issues to make progress on. And I think particularly in the UK, there is a widespread sense of urgency now that spans the political arenas, spans all houses of parliament, most levels of governance, central, sub-central, across the whole of the United Kingdom, that we've really been a long way behind the frontier on these issues. You know, the curve has moved very, very fast in the last two or three decades, and we've not really been up to speed, quite literally, in terms of how we've thought about it. There's been a lot of assumptions and assertions in the way that government works and thinks, which has not really well served us. And so there's a general sense across all areas of governance now that we're basically in a mess when it comes to these issues. And they're not marginal issues. It's not a party political issue. It's not a matter of just, you know, moving a few deck chairs around and somehow it'll all look much better. These are deep-seated, long-lasting, you know, in some sense almost intractable, but so deep-seated these challenges are. And it's the awareness of those which has shifted dramatically in recent years, that people have started to realize, actually, this is not good. You know, if I have a sense of what good looks like in terms of our livelihoods, this is not it. And in particular, that is a very, very place-based experience. We know that from the recent work done by the Policy Institute at King's, where they couple of years ago that you were surveying priorities, political priorities and social public policy priorities. And the one that came across that they were actually surprised about, I wasn't, of course, is that what people see as the most urgent and serious priority was basically inequality between places. And that spanned all political arenas. So I think in the UK, we are kind of psychologically, politically, emotionally in a very different space to where we were 20 years ago. Economically, there is no question we're in a completely different world. And those spatial things are central to those challenges. But also from the point of view as an academic, as a researcher, we're in a difficult space. That's why I'm happy to be part of this conversation with you guys, because we have to get as many people to think about how do we make progress. The more pairs of eyes and ears on this, the better, because this stuff is extraordinarily difficult, as well as being, you know, critical in terms of the future development of our country.
A great intro almost to our first provocation. I mean, sort of, you've diagnosed why it's urgent, why the UK's in a really problematic position. And we did start by saying, well, but what do we know now about solutions that we didn't perhaps know 10 or 20 years ago when the journey seems to have gone in the wrong direction? How easy is it going to be, or difficult is it going to be, to put some of the new knowledge about solutions into practice?
So I think there's various elements to this. The way I would answer it, even before I answer the question about solutions, there's an intermediate step. And that is that self-awareness as a society of where we are is critical in order to then start to seek solutions. You have to understand the situation you're in as best as possible in order to make sure that any solutions you're working towards are as grounded and as realistic as possible. And a difficulty in the UK is, until very recently, our self-awareness of these things was extraordinarily bad. And it was on various levels, but very widespread. So one of them is that for many decades, really, in the UK, there was just a kind of a sense of thinking amongst policymakers, going right up through Whitehall, you know, through to Treasury, for example. I've heard Treasury people say these things before at conferences, that there was just an assumption that when it comes to geographical, regional, local issues, when you're talking about the economy, there are just always inherent equity efficiency trade-offs. And in particular, as we talk about governance issues, the assumption that the more decentralized, the more devolved, that there's kind of an efficiency loss that is built into that. Whereas the more you have a kind of a centralized, tightly controlled economic system, then you're going to maximize efficiency gains. And that was also evident in terms of a lot of the thinking that really emerged in the 1980s, but then, you know, was really developed in the 1990s and early 2000s, particularly around the role around the London economy, the kind of the dominant city. And this is the period when I was coming into the field. You know, I was doing a PhD in the late 80s, early 90s. And so these are the kind of narratives I was picking up on all the time, that somehow this kind of concentration thing also was related to equity efficiency issues. What we know now is the reality is far more complex than that. So one of the things we know is that governance structures, whether they're more centralized or decentralized, has no effect in terms of aggregate growth rates. It's neither better nor worse. What it does do is shape the distributional benefits of growth. Countries which are much more devolved in terms of governance tend to grow internally more equally. Now, it seems to me that itself is an extremely important societal objective that you would want. More people partake in the benefits of growth. There's more people that feel that we're part of this. But there's no national economic effect either way. Whereas that was something that was embedded in a lot of thinking in the UK for decades, it's not true. Secondly, also, and I'll touch on this again a little bit later on, there was an assumption that basically spatial concentration, particularly in the London economy, will then automatically give rise to kind of diffusion spread effects. So that, you know, the London economy will affect, kind of help to lift all boats. The problem is that never happened in the UK. I'll talk about this in a bit more detail later on, but that's a very profound reality. The UK was the first country in which those mechanisms stopped working. Amongst all OECD countries, the UK was the first country in which all of those spread effects that you would expect stopped working. So we know now that that's true, but we don't know why. I've got plenty of suggestions as to why, but that is a fundamental problem. There are two of our key assumptions that we had previously 20, 30 years ago regarding spatial structures, governance structures, diffusion mechanisms. They simply did not hold in the UK case. So government thinking at all levels was predicated on a kind of a framework which turned out subsequently not to hold. And the third element is simply that the data wasn't there. As you know, it's really since the OECD and Eurostat, you know, put together this enormous data standardization effort over more than a decade, integrating and standardizing all the statistics from all the different national statistical offices within the OECD, that now we can tell the story properly. I mean, 20 years ago, well, less than 20 years ago, the data simply wasn't there. So what was happening was when policymakers were thinking about things, what you get is politicians would talk about what the previous government did or the previous administration. So we talk about the present and the future by just looking backwards all the time. That's not helpful. It doesn't get us anywhere unless that looking backwards is really designed to help us look forward in terms of learning lessons. But it wasn't really possible to do that because the data simply wasn't there. That's different today. The data is there. We can really compare country to country. So I think the first point is that our self-awareness position has changed dramatically. But we've still got a long way to go. But what that has done is it's opened up a whole new suite of potential ways of thinking, framing, narratives, whatever terminology you might want to use, that 20 years ago or 30 years ago was simply seen as just not admissible in many quarters. No, that's nonsense. You know, the economy doesn't work like that. Actually, people like me say, I'm afraid it does work like that. Not necessarily the way that you were assuming it had been. And that has then opened up lots of different ways. And so as an example, a very concrete example, is the whole place-based way of thinking about things now. Really, it has taken hold in many areas in the UK because people realize, one, it's important, it's critical, and two, everyone else seems to have been doing this for the last 30 years. We're the outlier. We were really the most space-blind country in terms of policy making in the OECD. The rest of the countries have just not been thinking about things in the way that we did. And I would argue they're much better positioned and developed to address these kind of problems. So that's also a question that what's new now is actually recently woken up to the fact that there are lots of other ways of thinking and doing these things because everyone else has been doing it. And we've got to think, okay, how can we learn lessons from those other countries that potentially can help us? That is a fundamental shift. It is very recent, but, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 35 years ago, it was simply a vacuum, this field. Today, it's a completely different reality.
Philip, I've heard you speak before eloquently about time that you have spent overseas, particularly in the Netherlands, and some of the lessons in decentralization and localized governance and how that relates to effective economic development. I wonder if you could kind of share with our listeners some of those insights about how things happen elsewhere.
I've spent more than half of my career actually outside of the UK. I've worked in the United States, in New Zealand, in the Netherlands, in Japan, in Thailand, in different roles, but always within the university role, but in each country also, working very closely with government agencies. And what struck me to very early date was that people's starting points, how they would frame a question, were often so different to what would be standard practice within the UK. In the early part of my career, a lot of my work tended to be very analytical, quite a lot of mathematics involved and so on. So I wasn't thinking about these governance types of issues, policy kind of issues in the same way. But what happened was over time, the more I came across this, where people would simply frame a discussion, starting point 101 was totally different. And I think, well, hang on a second, why do they ask questions like that or make those assumptions as their starting point? Whereas in the UK, the narrative would start from this point. And the more I experienced this in more different countries, I started to think, actually, this is part of the issue here. It's really important to understand how governance and economic systems work, because they work themselves within a framing kind of set of narratives about how the economy works, about how to prioritize things, about what is important, about what likely implications or outcomes of different things. And it was simply the enormous differences. And for example, I worked in New Zealand, and I also did a great deal of work with the Australian government as well as the New Zealand government. You know, they have almost the same institutional system to us as in terms of the legal system. It's almost identical. But they just frame all policy questions profoundly differently to us, even as a starting point. And it dawned on me that the reason is because of geography. The starting point in New Zealand, it's a country with a similar land area to the UK. It's slightly bigger, but, you know, with a population of around 5 million people, and on some indicators, it's the most isolated country in the world. So in terms of overall global population weighting. So how they think about how the economy works in the spatial sense is just totally unrelated to how we might think about it. Also, the spatial structure of their cities, how they relate to each other, what economic roles they play, how government sits in that and governance systems. The starting point is just fundamentally different. Australia, again, you know, it's as big as the whole of European Russia plus the rest of Europe. It's broken up into a state federal system. You know, how they ask government policy questions in Australia is almost, again, unrelated to how we think about these things in the UK. And yet, you know, government policy documents, you know, quite happily and quite blithely copy-paste things from Canada, US, Australia, as to kind of frame a narrative in terms of a UK policy document. And I suddenly thought, well, yeah, but these countries are less like us than it's possible to be. You know, they're gigantic countries geographically with very, very different geographical market areas, and institutionally, they're federal systems. You know, why didn't we start off saying, okay, you know, they're fundamentally different to us, so what can we learn? And then working in the Netherlands, which is the opposite, it's a very densely populated, even more densely populated than the UK, they're a unitary government system, so that's like the UK in general, even allowing for the devolved administrations. But they're a very bottom-up governance system. They're actually much closer to the Nordics than they are to somewhere like the UK, where bottom-up actions and activities, including decision-making, legal things, have precedence. You don't have this top-down ministerial fiat culture that we have in the UK, where a new minister can just come in and wave their hand and basically just, you know, abolish things and change stuff. We've seen that quite recently. I mean, you can't do stuff like that in the Netherlands. It's not possible. You can't do it in the Nordic countries. They work fundamentally differently. So it's this kind of framing that that's where I really came into the whole governance thing. What are the governance aspects that come into in terms of economic development? So I'd spent many years working on what you might think of as the more classic orthodox economics arguments, whereas really increasingly I started to understand that these governance, legal, political, institutional issues are absolutely critical. And of course, probably in the question of land use more than anything else. And so that's really how I've come to these things. And it was really, as I say, looking at the UK as an outsider, on one level being an insider, but on many levels being an outsider, because just spending so many years outside the country, but looking at it and finding it more and more puzzling the longer I looked at it. And actually that's very much shaped my work in general, subsequently with the European Commission, and most importantly for me with the OECD. I've worked with the OECD for 2 decades now, which really is all about looking at the experience across multiple countries, how they do things. And what you realize is the UK is a remarkable outlier. And I don't mean remarkable in any kind of gold medal sense. It's an outlier, the extent to which we do not look like other countries and don't do things like other countries. And it, yeah, I have my doubts as to how proud we should be of that when you look at the evidence and the data.
I think that's probably right. Being an outlier, would you be saying that part of the solution is, to some degree, about convergence? And if it is, what are the lessons that can be applied most effectively in some sort of UK transition or transformational process to rectify the over-centralist fiat-based system?
No, I think you're completely correct. I mean, convergence here, I'm understanding the way you phrased it, you're meaning convergence to something closer to the mainstream in the OECD in terms of how other countries institutionally operate their whole governance systems. I agree with that. I'll come back to the convergence in terms of regional economics in a little while. I'll come back to that. But convergence of institutional governance systems, yes. In 2016, I wrote a very, very large and very detailed book on the nature of the regional economic problem. It's called the UK Regional National Economic Problem. And it has a subheading, which is three Gs: geography, globalization, and governance. And my point was that the situation we've got ourselves into is a curious mixture of different influences. So one of them is just pure geography. I mean, we're a country where all of our dominant trade and communications and engagement networks go right through the center of the core capital region. Well, that's not true in any other country I can think of. You know, countries like Japan, Italy, Spain have multiple airline hubs. France is centralized on some levels, but so much of the trade of France doesn't go anywhere near Paris. It goes east into other parts of Europe, south to Spain, et cetera, et cetera. And if you look across the OECD, we're very unusual in that sense. So there is a kind of a natural inflationary bottleneck in the UK, which is focused on the southeast of England. And that makes planning issues around things like land use infrastructure more difficult than in many other countries. So that's one issue. And that relates to both institutional, micro, but also macro and monetary related issues. And I'll come back to that later. The second one is globalization. The UK, of course, was hit dramatically by the different effects of technical change, modernization in industry from the 1970s, 80s onwards. And a combination of those shocks, but also how they were adapted and managed in the UK, led to extremely severe adverse shocks in half the country. You know, there was a thinking at the time around competition, around deregulation, regulatory structure, and so on, that would be the best way to address these things. In hindsight, what we know is that those shocks were deeper in the UK than in other countries. We know that's the case. And partly because of the way it was responded to, that, you know, those places were not assisted or helped in the way in other countries they were intentionally assisted and helped. You know, that was the thinking at the time. That was a dominant line of thinking. In a sense, it will all come out of the wash. The market will solve a lot of these things. Well, it didn't. It hasn't. That's part of the problem now. So that's the kind of globalization shock. But the third one is the governance one, and it relates to the first two Gs, that in the last 40 years, the data, you start to see the changes in the data in about 1984-85. There's a fantastic data set called the Hoke and Marks data, Gary Marks and Lisbeth Hoke, who are at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and they monitor and build data sets on governance systems for all countries in the world, and you can download the data, it's free. And in the UK case, you start to see the shift from about 84, 85 onwards, that the UK starts to become more centralized in terms of governance systems. So regional units, areas, sub-central government starts to become less and less autonomous in its ability to make decisions, to deploy resources, to access resources, and so on. And this is a 40-year process in the UK. What is really strange is that the rest of the world started going in precisely the opposite direction, more or less at the same time. From the late 80s onwards, the early 90s, you start to see the rest of the industrialized world in general, not every single country, but the vast majority, becoming more decentralized. And one of my key arguments is that more devolved governments and more devolved governance systems has no bad effects in terms of macroeconomic growth. This is this equity efficiency assertion, which was in mainstream government in the UK 20, 30 years ago. There's simply no evidence at all of that. But what we do know is more devolved societies tend to grow internally more evenly, and that is a good thing of itself. And that has been the experience of most other countries. They were actively becoming more devolved at precisely the time when the UK was going in the opposite direction. And I think it hasn't served us well. It's served those countries better precisely because they're able to adopt more place-based ways of thinking, intervening, and so on. That would be my argument.
I mean, Philip, I mean, just as a perhaps a minor point, is that predominantly an England analysis? And what would you say about the establishments of the Scottish and Welsh governments, and to some extent London, you know, in the late 90s, for example? And why didn't that, to some extent at least, counter that prevailing centralisation?
I'm not a political scientist, so people who are political scientists will have much more attuned sense of these issues and explanations. For me, the difference is devolution as it existed in the UK, so I'm thinking of the devolved administrations, for example, to some extent in London as well, to a lesser extent, but it was primarily and overwhelmingly a political and cultural exercise. That's not to downplay it or to say it's not important, the opposite. I mean, that's precisely its legitimacy, and credibility is built on that. Whereas the devolution that I focused on is strangely apolitical. I don't think of it like that. I think of it much more operationally, the ability to implement decisions, to make better decisions and to implement them and in an operational manner, which is good for the economy as a whole. And those are things which can't be done in certain localities. That has to be a nationwide agenda. And in the United Kingdom, that simply wasn't the case. They were in specific localities. There was a very important and fundamental political and cultural logic in each case. They're different to each other, of course. The different devolved areas are quite different to each other in many ways, but there are commonalities. But what I'm thinking of in terms of economics is really about devolution per se, in terms of the way a whole polity works, the whole national UK-wide economy, and done in a manner which is fundamentally trying to deal with economic issues. Now, that's it's kind of a hard sell, that. And I've experienced this many times when I do a lot of public speaking about these issues, as well as speaking in kind of academic arenas. And I talk to many, many politicians on both sides of the House, both Houses of Parliament, people across Whitehall, you know, on a regular basis, and people in the media and so on. But it is a hard sell because people tend to think politically in terms of politics, which immediately gets you into personalities, culture, identity, and all these kind of things. Whereas fundamentally for me, these are not about that. They're about basically getting a system to work. You know, my view is in the end, if things work, the economy's going well, people are, you know, a lot of aspirations, there's jobs there, there's investment opportunities, there's career progression pathways. People tend to go with that. Most people, well, if that's the case, they're happy. And we didn't build a system that provided for that. It wasn't a UK-wide system. And devolution, as it was thought of as the UK, was not fundamentally an economic argument. And that's what we're struggling with now, because we realise many other countries did devolve precisely on economic grounds. And this is where, you know, we're 20 to 30 years behind the kind of frontier on this. And this is a difficult issue. And so I'm always careful when I talk about these things. And in a sense, you know, I'm happy that you've asked me this question, because I always try to take the political out of it. You know, this discussion, which is difficult, but in the English language, you know, policy and politics are two different words. In many languages, they're not. They're the same word. And, you know, it is an advantage in English that we can separate those two. But then how you articulate it in terms of the policy argument is often much more difficult. But for me, that is the only way I articulate it.
I wonder if we can revisit something that we briefly touched on at the beginning of the episode, which was about how the mechanisms for diffusing economic wealth from London to the rest of the country had sort of broken down roughly around the time of the financial crisis. Yeah, I wonder if you could speak a little more to the research that you've done about that.
Yes, I can. And this goes back to a very, very fundamental issue in terms of how we understand how regional economies work. So within a country, you've got lots of different sub-economies within that country, and they respond to different stimuli and shocks in different ways. But some countries, what you see is that the way the different parts of the country operate tends to be much more similar than others. So in the UK, what we have is a country where the experience over the last 30 to 40 years of the different parts of the country has been so dramatically different. And those differences, I would argue, and I have argued, and I've published all of this in terms of international academic journals, all the data and evidence, especially working with OECD colleagues, is that I would argue that those differences in the UK are amongst the highest in the industrialized world. That's something that you kind of hear in politics fairly regularly nowadays. I mean, that was primarily my work, more than anybody else's, working with people who work at Eurostat, the statistical office in the European Union, but most importantly, the teams who build the standardized data sets at the OECD. Those guys are fantastic. And working very closely with them. Now, the difficulty with this is, how did it happen? So one is this combination of three G's, as I've called it. But it's actually a more fundamental problem. It goes partway back to the global financial crisis, but it actually goes to two decades. The origins are actually two decades prior to the crisis. So if you go back to the 1980s, I remember when I was a student at university, I mean, you're a similar-ish generations to me. So you will recall that in the late 70s, early 80s, London was not a particularly prosperous city. When you compare London in those days with Tokyo, New York, Paris, you know, there were many parts of London that were really, really struggling. And London didn't have that cachet in terms of overall prosperity. So a general thinking that really went across all political parties and all areas of policy making, Whitehall and so on, was that we really have to focus on turning London round. And so London became an objective in terms of priority for a lot of big public investments or public-private investments, but those that involved a lot of public involvement, both financial but also in many cases legal and ministerial. So you think of obviously Docklands, the Channel Tunnel, the expansion to the Terminal 4, then Terminal 5, expansion of Gatwick, the Dartford Crossing, the completion of the M25, the plans for Crossrail, never mind the Crossrail 2, the expansion of the Jubilee Line. The list goes on, and also in cultural and heritage things. You know, the Sainsbury's Wing, the building of the Tate Modern, all of these things. There was a whole area of things, but particularly related to infrastructure, in transport, the built environment. These are very much often related to land use and planning decisions. So you think about the Docklands, for example. I mean, Heseltine played a crucial role in developing and pushing through a lot of the changes in terms of the legal basis to get these things to happen. I'm not criticizing him at all. I think Michael Heseltine was magnificent what he did. These things are happening, but there was a general consensus in all regions that we need to do this. But when you look at the economics at the time, it was perfectly well-founded. Because for four or five decades since the end of the Second World War, all OECD countries experienced what we call convergence processes in terms of economics. The weaker regions were catching the more prosperous regions in the same countries. And that convergence process was basically universal. Every single country in the OECD was experiencing that. And at the time, if you go to about 1978, 79, the UK actually had the smallest inter-regional variations. People forget that. In the post-war period, the UK consistently had, across by OECD standards, just about the lowest inter-regional variations, and other countries had much bigger inter-regional variations, but the weaker regions were converging, catching the more prosperous regions. That was true in the United States, but it was true all over Europe as well. And so the thinking was, well, what we need to do is we lift up London, and then that will just galvanize further convergence processes through knowledge diffusion, dissemination, best practice, multinational investment, all that good stuff will come in, and it will basically just diffuse through the UK economic system. And so it is, you know, literally lifting all boats. That was the idea. And up until that point, that was the reality of the whole of the OECD economies. The problem was you start to see the data change in 1988. I've still got my old copies of Regional Trends on the shelf. And that's where you start to see something else started to happen in the UK. Instead of everybody lifting and getting convergence, what you start to see is divergence. And the UK was the first country in the industrialized world in the post-war era to shift from being a convergence model to a divergence model. And that started in the late 80s and then accelerated through the 90s and early 2000s. Now, there were many good things going on in that period also in the weaker parts of the country. But when the economy is growing strong as a whole, the UK, if you remember, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, was about the third fastest growing country in the OECD. Inflation was, you know, pretty much tamed. Independent central bank, interest rates were not high. Growth was strong. You know, when you're in a framework like that, people don't complain. You know, people just get on with it because things seem to be going okay. But that divergence process was something already happening, and it was happening at tremendous speed, but everyone was growing. That was the point. But then what happened with the global financial crisis is that reality was shattered. It was truncated almost overnight. And then since then, what we've had is an economy which is very slow growth. In many parts of the country, no growth at all. And further widening of divergence. So now we've got an extremely toxic mixture of very little growth. And where the growth does exist, it's in the more prosperous places. And the other places are not growing at all. And, you know, many parts of the country today are no more prosperous than they were two decades ago. Half the UK today is poorer than the Czech Republic. And within a couple of years, Slovakia will be overtaking us and places like that. I mean, about 70 to 80% of the UK is already poorer than the poorer parts of the former East Germany. That's how to think about it. And this is a new reality again. You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the world looked very different. And this is where we are today. And we're struggling. What do we do?
Well, can I offer a solution based on really what I've heard in the last 40 minutes? And it is interesting because you do reflect a number of themes that we as a podcast have covered before. So, for example, we had an episode last summer with Professor Danny Dorling, where he actually articulated the divergence of models from the UK being one of the most equal countries in the OECD, or certainly, sorry, in Europe, alongside Sweden in the early 70s. And his prognosis was, well, we followed the US model rather than the Scandi model, and we're now the most unequal. Secondly, we had an episode again last year, and it builds on your London point, which actually explored the quantum of investment around the Olympics that was able to build a sustainable transformation of East London. And in fact, we bemoaned the lack of comparable commitment to that scale, whether it's East German size or Lee Valley, for want of a better word, you know, in UK less developed regions and cities. And I mean, taking your 2016 book, which is a fantastic book, the 3 G's, I mean, what I think I've heard has been, you know, tackle the geography through a national spatial strategy, tackle the globalization issues by having, you know, fit for purpose and levels of public investment that we don't typically see outside London, and tackle the governance through meaningful devolution of economic powers, resources, capabilities. I mean, is that a fair starting point for the way forward?
Yes, exactly. I mean, that is what I argue, is that it's not one thing, it's multiple things, and they all have to be done together. And they'll take a long time, but it's taken us a long time to get into this mess. and it's an enormous mess. It's going to take us a long time to get out of it, but we have to do a lot of things at the same time. So a starting point is National Spatial Strategy. I was very involved in the work of the UK 2070 Commission, led by Lord Bob Kerslake, and also the One Powerhouse Consortium, led by Sir Hugh Sykes. They've done some fantastic work, also alongside the Royal Society of Arts, on thinking about how to develop UK spatial strategies on very wide regional levels. You know, this is what other countries do. I mean, I used to, when I taught in the Netherlands, there was a master's program in our faculty, environment and infrastructure planning. They'd have 100 students, upwards to, you know, sometimes 150 students every single year. I don't think there's a single course in the UK that teaches that. And I would open, I'd always give a guest lecture, and I'd start off with, the UK, we don't have a spatial plan. They all laughing. They start laughing because they think it's kind of an icebreaker just to get the conversation going. And then they realize they're dead, I'm dead serious. And for, you know, people in the Netherlands and Germany, this is just, it's impossible to think of the world without having a proper spatial planning strategy. How do you do anything? That would be their first question. And my response would be, well, quite. Exactly. How do you do anything? So, getting land use planning serious. We don't have a land use planning strategy. We have an ad hoc development control system. That is not a land use planning strategy. We need land use planning strategies which are medium and long term, because otherwise it's impossible to prioritize and plan for investment, particularly related to infrastructure. And our infrastructure is woeful on so many levels, as we know. We need a land use planning strategy. We need much more, you know, real devolved governance, not, you know, central government just handing out little packets of money for this policy or that program for the next year or two. I mean, serious governments where devolved governments have proper capabilities, capacity, resources, legal powers to make decisions which are much closer to the action on, based on better knowledge. And also they can act as convening platforms to bring people together. That's how the Australians work. It's how the Canadians work. It's how the Americans, the Germans, the Belgians, the Dutch, all the Nordics. This is precisely how they work. We don't, except we are moving in the right direction. Particularly, I think the city region mayoral authorities. I think obviously the work of both Andy Street, Andy Burnham, in many areas has been very much in the vanguard, leading these new ways of thinking. And obviously Steve Rotherham and Ben Houchin, Tracy Braben, they're all driving different types of innovation approaches to local economic development. But that's what we need. We need more and more of this, and it's a bigger scale, both in terms of geographically and also financially and legally. We need to empower places to start to take the reins of their own future in their own hands. Why is that critical? What you don't want to do is cut places off. Just devolve is basically fragment and decentralize. That's the worst outcome. Places need to be supported, but supported to take their own decisions and to go with them. Why? Because then you're working on a decision-making level that the private investment community understand. They can sit down with the key people in the locality, the specialists. They can look at the evidence. They can look at the planning, the legal issues. That they can start to fit their own investment and business plans to dovetail them with what the local objectives are. That's how you start to get good governance. It becomes built into the system, and it's how you build that confidence for the investment community. And why this is so critical is a point I made right at the beginning, but I didn't elaborate on. One of the things that we've been working on at the Productivity Institute is we've been looking at using fantastic real estate data to calculate risk premia across cities and regions and sectors. So to understand how the markets really price in and value a place. And it's what's called the external finance premium. It's an issue most associated with Ben Bernanke, Nobel Prize winner, former chairman of the US Fed. It's the difference between how investors really price a place over the risk, the discount rate that you get from the central banks. So, you know, quantitative easing pushes down interest rates to very low levels. But do investors really think investing in Middlesbrough or Blackburn is going to be priced in at very, very low levels? No, they don't think that at all. They think this is really risky. And so their risk premium that they add on to the official discount rates is extremely high. And what we've been able to calculate we've shown that across the UK, the difference between London and the rest of the UK, you're looking at many, 250 basis, 300 basis points, which to people, a lot of people think, I don't know what that means. That's about the difference between the Bank of England and the Bank of Romania. So think about how investors looking at the UK think about the economy. Do they think about us as a single integrated economy? No, not even remotely. They look at the different parts of the UK as being as extreme as the whole variation across the US and the European Union. These are enormous differences. So the key thing about devolution is to build institutional systems that will narrow those risk premia. So investors start to recover the confidence that actually I do want to go to Sunderland, I do want to go to Birkenhead and Blackpool because there's good investment opportunities for me, and I'm going to price them in very competitively. As an economist, that's how I view the world. And all this devolution-related stuff, in the end, we have to be able to persuade the private investors to do the heavy lifting. And that's what's needed. But it's doable. It's happened in Newcastle, New South Wales. It's happened in Pittsburgh. It's happened in Windsor, Ontario, Duisburg, Dortmund, and Germany. If those guys can do it, then there's no reason we can't.
Right. Well, I'm glad that we're drawing to a close on an optimistic note. Mike, can I give you the last word before we wind it up?
Thanks, David. Well, thanks, Philip, for a real tour de force through the themes of economic development that David and I love to touch on. It's been great to hear. And I should say, as we sign off as well, I've heard you speak before about the risk premium work, and I would encourage anybody listening to this to visit the Productivity Institute's website, where you can access some of that research. It's absolutely fascinating reading, some of the most fascinating research, certainly that I've read in recent years, and gives you a real sense of where we're at and how regional divergences are playing out. So do go and visit the website. Do go and access that work if you're listening to this. So it just remains for me to say thanks for listening to the podcast. As ever, you can put bonus material on this and other episodes at ledconfidential.co.uk. Drop us a line, leave us some comments. Ideas for future episodes, we're always grateful for those. Until the next time, thank you very much for listening.